As Murphy pointed out to you there, that was unscreened, which means he saw it for the very first time as you saw it. Unedited films of what happened, some of what happened in the motorcade. If I might explain to you that blurry and confusing scene, obviously what happened. When the shots were fired, the cameraman who was riding in one of the cars behind the president, very wisely, kept his camera running, even as he jumped from the car and ran towards the president's car, and then over towards the people who were shielding themselves, ducking down, trying to avoid what was going on. It was the only way the cameraman could have gotten you a picture of what went on. He very wisely took no time to try to wind the spring on the camera or anything else. Just keep it rolling, get as much picture as possible, and get as close as possible to the scene of action. That is what the cameraman did. That is why it looked somewhat unorthodox in terms of what you are used to seeing. And that is why it's such a precious piece of film, because the cameraman thought. Frank?
Well, just this, that former President Hoover has issued the following statement. Mr. Hoover says, I am shocked and grieved to learn of President Kennedy's assassination. He loved America and has given his life for his country. I join our beloved nation in heartfelt sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and their two children. A few moments ago, we were trying to bring you film that was made of the president's last formal speech, and I understand now that this is ready to go. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in what has proved to be his last formal speech, the late President John Fitzgerald Kennedy's comments to a dinner in Houston, Texas, only last night, concerned themselves, paradoxically, with the glowing and progressive future. The president arrived in Houston to be greeted by large crowds of enthusiastic supporters. In fact, it was with a view to building up voter support in Texas that Mr. Kennedy made his two-day so-called non-political tour. The late president had carried the state by narrow margins in 1960 with what has been conceded to be the important support of Mr. Lyndon Johnson, at that time the vice presidential candidate. Mrs. Kennedy also made the trip in what was her first public appearance since the tragic birth and death of their third child, Patrick. Mr. Kennedy was in Houston to take part at a testimonial dinner for Representative Albert Thomas, one of the most influential members of Congress. Thomas is considered to have been instrumental in gaining for the Houston area the substantial United States investment in the Man to the Moon program. Throughout his Texas tour, the late president was accompanied by Governor John Connally, a friend and a political ally of Mr. Lyndon Johnson. Political commentators have argued that Mr. Kennedy's visit was also designed to smooth over the rift in Texas politics, a rift which had been widened by last year's gubernatorial contest between Don Yarbrough, a liberal Democrat, and Governor Connally, who won. Connally was allied with the more conservative elements of the Democratic Party. The late president is understood to have sought a compromise between the warring factions in order to achieve a unified effort to carry Texas for the Democrats in 1964. All of these maneuverings, of course, have been made futile, struck down by the shot which has been fired from an assassin's gun today. Lyndon Johnson is now president of the United States. Governor Connally is now in a Dallas hospital, reportedly in serious condition as a result of a bullet in the lung. In his remarks before the Houston audience last night, Mr. Kennedy spoke about the place that Texas and the United States will take in the space efforts of the next decade. The late president referred specifically to the important firing of the Saturn booster, which is scheduled to take place next month. And he also referred to the Race to the Moon, a project which had occupied an important place in his presidential program. The subject is of special interest to Texans, not only because of the manned spacecraft center at Houston, but also because of the continued interest in space and allied subjects which Mr. Johnson has for many years championed. It fell to Lyndon Johnson to praise Congressman Thomas, and in doing so, the new president recalled an anecdote which might well have been applied to himself. This in Houston, and we are to hear, first, I believe, the vice president.
Congressman Thomas, Mrs. Thomas, Mr. President, Ms. Kennedy, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. Some years ago, someone asked Speaker Rayburn why it happened that the Texas delegation in Congress had such an uncommon influence upon the course of national affairs. Mr. Rayburn's reply was characteristically pointed and quite brief. He said, we pick them honest, we pick them young, we send them there, and we keep them there.
Then President Kennedy spoke, referred to Thomas as one of the most remarkable members of Congress. And what was to be his last major address, the president said,
"Next month, when the United States of America fires the largest booster in the history of the world into space for the first time, giving us the lead, fires the largest payload into space, giving us the lead, it will be the largest payroll, too. Who should know that better than Houston? In 1990, your sons, daughters, grandsons, and grandchildren will be applying to the colleges of this state in a number three times what they do today. Our airports will serve five times as many passenger miles. We will need housing for 100 million more people and many times more doctors and engineers and technicians than we are presently producing. That is why we're trying to do more in these areas. As in the 30s, Albert Thomas and Franklin Roosevelt and others did those things which make it possible for not only Texas, but the entire United States to prosper and grow as we do in the 1960s. In 1990, the age of space will be entering its second phase, and our hopes in it to preserve the peace, to make sure that in this great new sea, as on Earth, the United States is second to none."
President John Fitzgerald Kennedy in Houston, Texas last night, vibrant and alive, looking forward to the future, now dead, felled by an assassin's bullet in Dallas, Texas, as he continued his tour of that southwestern state.
And, Frank, we now have this. The presidential plane is airborne. It has left Love Field in Dallas, carrying President Lyndon Johnson to Washington. Mr. Johnson was sworn in, we have a correction in the time, less than an hour ago at 3:39 Eastern Standard Time as President of the United States. He was sworn in by a district judge, Sarah Hughes, aboard the presidential plane parked at Love Field, where it had come in earlier this morning to Dallas and deposited then-President Kennedy and his party. At the swearing-in of Lyndon Baines Johnson as President of the United States were Mrs. Kennedy, the late President's widow, and Mrs. Johnson, now the First Lady of the land, several staff members and several congressmen, apparently those who had been in the presidential party for this swing into Texas. Mr. Johnson asked as many White House people as possibly could to crowd into the executive suite of the airplane, Air Force One, to witness the ceremony. Judge Hughes, who administered the oath, is said to have been weeping while she swore Mr. Johnson in as President of the United States. Then the plane took off immediately for Washington with President Johnson, Mrs. Kennedy, and some White House aides aboard. Again, it is a question of reaction, a question of Washington shifting, getting used to a change, in spite of the fact that it came violently and dramatically. One of the changes will take place in the area of foreign policy. How much? Reported now by NBC's State Department correspondent Ellie Abel in Washington.
All we can be sure about at the moment is the great shockwave felt around the world, not only among friends and allies and neutrals, but also, I suspect, in the communist-ruled countries. The controlled Soviet press has much of the time been sharply and automatically critical of U.S. policy, but the person of John F. Kennedy was treated with respect. Just a week ago, the Soviet people were told that Yale Professor Boghorn, arrested as a spy, was being released because of the president's concern over the case. He had met Soviet Premier Khrushchev in Vienna in 1961, resisted Soviet encroachments on Berlin, played and won that deadly game of nuclear poker with Khrushchev over Cuba. He was also the man who agreed to a limited test ban treaty and persuaded the U.S. Senate to ratify that step. The guess here is that President Lyndon Johnson will carry on much the same policy. He was certainly very much directly involved in that policy. He showed the flag in many distant parts of the world as President Kennedy's personal emissary. But just as the Western allies may hesitate while pledging full support to the new president, the Soviets presumably are not sure at the moment what to expect out of Washington. They have tended to place a certain faith in John Kennedy personally, as a man they disagreed with, but a man who wanted peace. who was trying to defuse some of the explosive situations around the world, who favored, in the long run, a policy based on mutual recognition that nuclear war is no rational option for mankind in this day and age. The Russians know less about Lyndon Johnson, and they may well play a waiting game until they have a surer feel of his reactions and attitudes. Kelly Abel, NBC News, reporting.
More from Dallas now on what may be, I repeat, may be, the capture of the assassin. We know this much. One man has been taken into custody. He was taken into custody in the Texas Theater in Dallas, specifically for killing a Dallas policeman. We're told this, that a check was made of the building in which the shots that killed President Kennedy were fired, and they found a rifle on the fifth floor of that building. Police then received a tip that a man suspected as the assassin had gone into the Texas Theater. Two Dallas policemen went into the theater. They were told by an usher that a man had just come in. They spotted him. One policeman fired at the suspect, who returned the fire, killing the first policeman. There was shooting within the theater. The other policeman then arrested the suspect, who yelled, "It's all over now." He was clapped into handcuffs and taken out. We do not yet know if this is the man who fired the shot that killed President Kennedy. I am told that our station in Fort Worth, Dallas, has more late film. So for a report, we go to station WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, Dallas.
Hundreds of persons witnessed the shooting in Dallas just after the noon hour. We have films of eyewitness reports. Coming up is a statement by Charles Brand, who was on the sidewalk and saw the shooting.
Unfortunately, I was probably 15 to 20 feet away from the president when it happened.
Tell us exactly what you saw, sir.
He was coming down the street, and my five-year-old boy and myself were by ourselves on the grass there on Palmer Street, and I asked Joe to wave to him, and Joe waved, and I waved, and the man...
That's all right, sir.
You go ahead and say it. As he was waving back, he was... The shot rang out, and he slumped down in the seat, and his wife reached up toward him, and he was slumping down, and the second shot went off, and it just knocked him down in the seat.
Two shots.
Did you see the man who did the...
No, sir, I did not see the man who did it. All I did was look in the man's face when he was shot there and saw that expression on his face and grabbed himself and slide.
And the second one, whenever it went, why, I'm positive it had hit him. I hope it didn't, but I'm positive that it hit him, and he went all the way down in the car. Then they speeded up, and I didn't know what was going on, so I just grabbed the boy and fell on him in hopes that there wasn't a maniac around. I'm sorry. I can't help you more, but I won't forget.
Polaroid picture taken by another witness, Mary Norman of Dallas, showing the president slumped over in the car.
Just as Mary started to take the picture and the president came right even with us, two shots, we looked at him and he was looking at a dog in the middle of the seat, two shots rang out and he grabbed his chest and a look of pain on his face and fell across toward Jackie, and she fell over on him and said, "My God, he's shot." And there was an interval, and then three or four more shots rang out, but that time the motorcade had sped away.
What prompted you to take the picture at that particular instant, ma'am?
Well, that's the only chance I had. Mine is a Polaroid, and I can only take one every 10 seconds, and it was at that time whenever
I
took it.
Did you know he was shot?
No, I didn't. I must have sensed it immediately when he slumped, because in the picture that's the way she's there, and he slumped over.
Did you see the person who fired the...
No, not, I didn't see any person fire the weapon.
You only heard it?
I only heard it. And I looked up and saw a man running up this hill.
Could you tell me, you had no idea?
No, I had no idea. I had nothing to go by. I mean, I don't think it dawned on me for an instant that the president had been shot. I mean, I knew, and yet it just didn't register.
Did you get a look at the
No, I had taken the picture and then the shots, and I decided it was time to fall on the ground.
You did fall on the ground. Mary Norman was the woman who took the picture on the right. The other woman was a companion, Jean Hill. Coming up again now are films of the last minutes of President Kennedy's life, the actual shooting scene in Dallas. Presidential motorcade is passing the City Hall in Dallas, also containing the police department, which had pled extra precautionary measures against possible violence. A big crowd gathered along the sidewalks of Main Street. He passed down Main Street during the height of the noon hour, after speaking in Fort Worth, where he had spent the night. The motorcade is moving slowly west, about 20 miles an hour. No estimate of the crowd has ever been made. Past workmen, past office workers, past thousands of young people who had cut classes at school to see the president and his attractive wife. That is the school depository on the right, the building from which the sniper fired. Now these are the last moments of president. This is the shooting scene, a confused moment, as the cameraman runs toward the presidential car, leaving his camera running all the while. Past a park. A woman taking shelter on the lawn of a park. Another man holding his son. Another woman crouching in the presidential car, hurrying toward Parkland Hospital. Confusion everywhere. A long picket past the Dallas trademark where the president was to speak. In his address, he was to criticize the fanatical right. This is Parkland Hospital, some 2 miles from the shooting scene. By now, the presidential car with the dying president has already arrived. The president died 30 minutes after the shooting in the hospital emergency room. This is the emergency room of Parkland Hospital, the public hospital in Dallas, Texas. This is Major General Clifton, the military aide. Late word just in from Dallas. Homicide Detective Lavelle told WBAP newsman James Kerr in Dallas a few minutes ago they have little doubt that 24-year-old Lee Oswald of Dallas is the man who shot and killed Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit shortly after President Kennedy was shot to death this afternoon. Oswald was pulled screaming and shouting from the Texas Theater by officers who had gone there on a tip that Oswald was there. He brandished a pistol which officers took away from him after a struggle. Oswald was quoted as saying, "It's all over now." A large crowd had congregated around the theater and police had to hold back the crowd because they were of the impression that the man was the president's assassin. Officer Tipper had been killed by a man answering the description of Oswald in the neighborhood a short time before. The coincidence in the case is that Oswald worked as a stockman at the Texas Book Depository, the building from which the sniper shot President Kennedy. Dallas police have declined to say whether they think Oswald is connected to the assassination. This other late word in, a 24-year-old man who said 2 years ago he wanted Russian citizenship was questioned today to see whether he had any connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. He was identified as Lee Harvey Oswald of Fort Worth. He was pulled screaming and yelling from the Texas Theater in the Oak Fifth section of Dallas shortly after a Dallas policeman was shot to death. As more late film arrive, we will show them instantly, unedited, unscreened. This is Charles Murphy reporting from WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, Dallas.
Now, there's just one conflict between what Charles Murphy has just reported to you and what we have from the wires coming out of Dallas. The indications are in the last story we had here that the suspect had been taken into custody, Oswald, and the dead Dallas policeman engaged in a shooting affray within the Texas Theater where the suspect was ultimately taken into custody. However, Murphy reported that the killing of the policeman took place in the vicinity, that Oswald was then chased into the theater and then arrested. We do not yet know, and as Murphy pointed out, Dallas police have not yet indicated whether they feel there is a connection between this man and the assassination of President Kennedy. But Murphy did report that the man was employed as a stock clerk in the building from which the fatal shots were fired. And there was also the report that 2 years ago he said he would like to have Russian citizenship. Frank?
Bill, we have... I think we have some late information from WDAP in Fort Worth, so let's go there and to Charles Murphy.
Here is more information about the suspect Oswald. On November 1, 1959, Oswald told the United States Embassy in Moscow he had applied for Soviet citizenship. He said he had been sent a tour. He had been a tourist, rather, in Russia since October 13th of that year. Oswald was reported to have a Russian wife. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram confirmed that the man held in Dallas was the same Oswald and said his mother was being taken to Dallas police headquarters to see him. Oswald put up a wild fight in the theater. Charles Murphy reporting from WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, Dallas.
There is this late report on the condition of Texas Governor John Conley. He is said to be in very, very serious but not critical condition. An aide said he suffered three wounds, one in the right arm, one in the right leg, one in the back that pierced his body. And an aide to the governor says the governor had been in surgery an hour, probably would be there for another hour. Frank?
Oh, just thinking back, Bill, a little earlier in the day when we allowed ourselves to have some hope, when we were told that the Texas governor had been taken into the emergency room in the hospital there, it appeared that he perhaps was in more critical condition than the president. This was an instant mental reaction. I suppose had we been inclined to be more pessimistic, we would have realized then that perhaps the president was beyond much medical help.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new arrival time for President Kennedy's body in Washington. It's now estimated that the plane will touch down at Andrews Air Force Base just outside the nation's capital at 6.05 p.m. Eastern Standard Time today, which is, what, about an hour and a half? Roughly an hour and a half from now. And that the plane that some members of the cabinet and Press Secretary Salinger were taking to the Far East has, of course, turned around and is headed back to Washington, and that it has touched down in Honolulu on its way back to the United States. Phil?
There is little, very little, actually, that we can add to what we have already brought you thus far. We have lost the president. Lyndon Johnson has been sworn in as the new president. He is now flying on Air Force One to Washington, and our information is that he is on the same aircraft that is bringing the president's body, the late president's body, back to Washington, D.C. It's expected there at 6.05, as Frank mentioned, Eastern Standard Time, about an hour and a half from now. Also on the plane with President Johnson, Mrs. Johnson, and Mrs. Kennedy, the widow of the late president. Yes, Frank.
We mentioned a while ago that this federal judge, Sarah Hughes, is that correct,
yes,
who swore in President Johnson, that the swearing-in ceremony took place aboard the presidential jet. That certainly is the first time that's ever happened in history.
Also the first woman to administer.
The first woman to ever administer the oath of office. These have occurred under unusual circumstances, I recall, and I'm trusting memory here, that when President Calvin Coolidge was sworn in, he was sworn in by his father in Vermont. Is that correct?
Vermont? I think so.
His father was living in Vermont at that time. He was quite an elderly man, was a justice of the peace. Coolidge was roused from bed and told about the death of President Harding, and his elderly father, a justice of the peace, swore him in as President of the United States. It seemed to many at that time fitting that the ceremony would be very simple, take place in the parlor of this quite conservative old house in rugged New England territory. He was a president's Kennedy's assassination has mercifully been withheld from his 98-year-old maternal grandmother who lives in Boston. Mrs. John Fitzgerald is her name. She lives with a son, Thomas Fitzgerald, and he says he doesn't think that he will ever tell his mother that her grandson, the President of the United States, is not dead. and the 16-year-old daughter of Lyndon Johnson was in class today at the National Cathedral School for Girls in Washington when she heard of the assassination of President Kennedy. An aide to President Johnson said she told the school principal to release her to nobody but to the Secret Service. And the aide, Miss Willie Day Taylor, went to the Johnson home to be there when Lucy, the daughter, arrived. A moment ago, we showed you some film that was made last night in Houston, Texas, when the president arrived there, and we had excerpts of the speech that he made. We have some more now, film made in San Antonio, and if we're ready, somebody indicate to me. President Kennedy flew to Texas, as you know, only yesterday in what was to be a two-day tour with major speeches in San Antonio and Houston. The President and Mrs. Kennedy, both in the Air Force jet, arrived at San Antonio's International Airport. And his mission was to dedicate the new Aerospace Medical Health Center at nearby Brooks Air Force Base. This is in San Antonio. And his intention, too, was to spend some of the 48 hours in Texas in old-fashioned politicking. At the San Antonio Airport and later in the motorcade to Brooks, the crowds were large. Welcome was friendly. The president rode in his open car with Texas Governor John Connally, Jr. In San Antonio, in fact, in all of Texas, this is the truly space-conscious territory, and so the focus of the president's visit to Brooks Air Force Base was an enthusiastic defense of this nation's space program. With Mrs. Kennedy on the platform, the president helped dedicate the new $6 million Aerospace Health Center, and in just a moment we will hear an excerpt of the remarks that he made.
So, Mr. Mr. Secretary, Governor, Vice President, Senator, members of the Congress, members of the military, ladies and gentlemen, for more than 3 years, I've spoken about the new frontier. This is not a partisan term, and it's not the exclusive property of Republicans or Democrats. It refers instead to this nation's place in history, to the fact that we do stand on the edge of a great new era, filled with both crisis and opportunity. An era to be characterized by achievement and by challenge. It is an era which calls for action, and for the best efforts of all those who would test the unknown and the uncertain in every phase of human endeavor. It is a time for pathfinders and pioneers. I have come to Texas today to salute an outstanding group of pioneers. The man who manned the Brooks Air Force Base School of Aerospace Medicine and the Aerospace Medical Center.
The United States' effort in space was a major issue in the 1960 presidential campaign that resulted in the election of John Fitzgerald Kennedy to the White House. He immediately launched an increased program called for greater appropriations, an approach that has recently run into increasing criticism, particularly at times to consider the appropriation bill. He was in Texas, not only to politic for the 1964 campaign, but also to in part justify the expenditures that had been made and call for an even greater effort in space. So we would like now an examination of President Kennedy as a space age president and his attitude toward the new challenge of the outer dimensions. Before this, we would go to our studios in Washington and NBC's Peter Hackus.
Well, Frank, as most offices here in Washington, both the Pentagon and NASA, most of the people who are who once knew the president, even on a very casual basis, are speechless at this point. They felt they had a friend and a very genuine booster in Mr. Kennedy, despite the fact that he and they differed from time to time over specific projects. He was, after all, the first president of the so-called space age. He stepped in at a time when, as you recall, we were lagging behind in various areas. He did his very best to fight for what he thought the nation needed in the way of defense and to get along in space. All the way through, he was one who, through our speeches and our developments at the United Nations, including his own speech, decided that the future of outer space was to be peaceful, at least as far as this country was concerned. He was very severely criticized by many for his stand. A number of people in Congress thought it was it was sheer folly to stand up at the United Nations and preach peace in space when the Russians were presumably getting so far ahead of us, There is no proof, of course, that they are ahead of us in these various areas, but it did have its effect, as you saw very recently in Congress, when they pared back the amount of money the president had asked for our space program and going to the moon. He believed in it. He wanted cooperation to the very best of his ability with whatever safeguards we could pick up along the way. He was a friend, as I said, also of the military. He had visited most of the military, major military installations in this country, as well as our space installations. I remember being with him both at Cape Canaveral and at Houston when he was getting his first real look-see into the Project Mercury and what lies beyond. At one point, he stood aside and was chatting informally with one of the astronauts who was on hand rather conveniently to show him the marvels of the space age. And he remarked aloud that he marveled, first of all, that anyone could get in to that capsule. And we recall some of his joking with John Glenn when the astronaut was here in Washington about some of the things that he had seen from space. And once at the Cape, he was overheard to remark that had things been a little bit different with him, he too might have liked to make a trip into space. So he was a pioneer in that sense. He wanted to do new things. He was constantly leading, and he was most interested in all of the technical aspects of how you get into space, how you get back, and what is the best, the latest and best for the military. President Johnson presumably will make no major changes either in the military or space, except that he may be expected to continue to pound hard to keep the United States ahead or to push it ahead in various aspects of space. He has been the head of the President's Space Council. He's been kept informed of all of the technical developments. He is a booster of this effort and is expected to go along in that general trend. One Pentagon man, when I called over there today, was in a state of shock, but rather broken up. He said the death of Mr. Kennedy won't stop anything here. We'll carry on where he left off. The military officers, traditionally, the Army is in charge of state funerals where the military is involved. They are, a number of those people are at the White House at this moment discussing the various possibilities should a military funeral or anything having to do with Arlington be on the agenda. Whether or not they will be involved, there will surely be a funeral cortege of one kind or another through at least part of Washington. It has been a tradition that the military caissons, the horses, the smartly dressed ceremonial troops take part, and they are ready, I'm told, at this moment to do whatever they can, whatever they're called upon to do. There was one officer in this general area with whom I spoke, the same age as the president, and as he put it to me, it was like this: it's almost too difficult to think that we'll be doing this sad duty. This is Peter Hackus, NBC News, Washington.
What has happened is numbing. There are, I think, few people who can understand it. You can appreciate the fact that Mr. Kennedy is, in fact, dead. He comes as a tremendous shock and does numb. I think perhaps our ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, has summed it up with this statement: the tragedy of this day is beyond instant comprehension. All of us who knew him will bear the grief of his death to the day of ours. And all men everywhere who love peace and justice and freedom will bow their heads. At such a moment, we can only turn to prayer. Prayer to comfort our grief, to sustain Mrs. Kennedy and his family, to strengthen President Johnson, and to guide us in time to come. May God help us. The words of Ambassador Adlai Stevenson, spoken this afternoon at the United Nations. Frank?
As this chaotic situation continues, more and more pieces of the story begin to fall into place, and some of the reports that we brought you in fragmentary form earlier are being clarified. It is now apparent that no Secret Service men were injured in the attack on President Kennedy. A top Treasury official said today that Robert A. Wallace, Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, under which the Secret Service operates, said the service had received a report that a Dallas policeman had been killed by the fusillade from an assassin. It had been reported from Dallas that a policeman and a Secret Service man had been shot and killed some distance from the scene of the attack on the president. The Assistant Secretary, who had worked for Mr. Kennedy in the Senate, is in charge of Secret Service policy and advises on fiscal matters. Now, just a little while before he was assassinated, Mrs. Kennedy turned to her husband and said, "You can't say Dallas wasn't friendly to you." Mrs. John Connolly, wife of the wounded Texas governor, said that Mrs. Kennedy turned to her husband and made that remark as they rode past cheering crowds in Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy, wearing a stunning pink wool suit and matching pink pillbox hat, had a bunch of yellow roses with her in the open-top limousine. They had been presented to her at the Dallas airport. So the roses remained in the blood-spattered car outside the hospital where her husband was at that time dying. She clutched her husband to her as he slumped forward in the seat of the car. She knelt on the floor over him during the high-speed ride to Parkland Hospital's emergency ward. Mrs. Kennedy helped lift her dying husband onto a stretcher. She was taken inside the hospital and whisked from view. She appeared stunned as she entered the hospital. Physicians attending the president said they did not take time to notice whether she or any members of the White House staff were with the president at the precise moment of his death. Members of the White House party said Mrs. Kennedy's first thought then was to be with her children, Caroline 6 and John Jr., who will be 3 next week and who, at last report, were at the White House in Washington. Mrs. Kennedy was taken to Love Field in Dallas, and there, on the plane that carried her to what had been a personal triumph for her in Texas, she joined witnesses as Lyndon B. Johnson was sworn into office as Chief Executive of the United States. The casket of her husband was placed aboard the plane. Mrs. Johnson, the new First Lady, embraced Mrs. Kennedy, and she rode back to the Capitol with the new president. We are going to return you to WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, and Charles Murphy with some film that was made at the hospital where the president died. Go to WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, and Charles Murphy.
Late films have arrived in our newsroom from Dallas showing the scenes of horror and disbelief outside Parkland Hospital. Newsmen hurry to the emergency room. The president's wife arrived, stunned. This is Mrs. Kennedy in the middle. At this point, no one knew, whether the president was alive or dead. Mrs. Kennedy conferring with a Dallas policeman who had sped the president to the hospital and into the emergency room goes Mrs. Kennedy. A corsage of roses lies inside the car in which President Kennedy was shot. A stunned Congressman Jim Wright of Fort Worth tells what he saw from a few cars back. The disbelief registered on every face. These films from outside the emergency room of Parkland Hospital in Dallas as the president is dying inside. Senator Ralph Yarbrough, who saw the shooting, said he heard shots and then saw a Secret Service man pound his fist against the rear fender of the presidential car in anguish. Two priests arrived to administer last rites. Their names are not yet known. The deed still is not registered with many outside the hospital. Horror begins to sink in. We'll be back with more films from Dallas as soon as they arrive. Charles Murphy, WBAP-TV, Fort Worth, Dallas.
There is this reaction to the death of President Kennedy from French President Charles de Gaulle, who said President Kennedy died like a soldier under fire for his duty and in the service of his country. In the name of the French people, ever the friend of the American people, I salute this great example and this great memory. There is also a reaction from Canada, our neighbor to the north, and we have that report as recorded in this conversation with our NBC correspondent, Leif Eve, in Ottawa.
A deeply shaken Prime Minister Lester Pearson announced the news of President Kennedy's death to Canada's House of Commons. An aide walked to his front bench shortly before the beginning of the afternoon session and handed him a slip of paper. In a voice that was close to the breaking point several times, the Prime Minister told a hushed Commons that the President's death is a tragedy for all of us. No people, he said, will share more deeply in that tragedy than the people of Canada, the neighbors of the United States. He said, our hearts are filled with sadness. The Prime Minister was a longtime personal friend of the late President, dating from the time when Mr. Pearson was Canadian ambassador to Washington and Mr. Kennedy was a senator. The Prime Minister's tribute was followed by those of the other party group, and Commons immediately adjourned until Monday. All Canadian radio and television stations broke schedules to carry uninterrupted news of the President's assassination and to recall his 1961 visit to Canada. BBC News, Ottawa.
Not to dwell on maudlin items or to become too morose in this, but the Kennedy children, Caroline and John, as has been mentioned before, were at the White House today when they lost their father in Dallas, Texas. There is a story from Washington that it's believed that the task of telling them what has happened will be left to Mrs. Kennedy. And it's also recalled that earlier this year when she lost a baby, that the task of telling the children was left to the father, the president, who informed Caroline and young John that they had lost their baby brother. The children, to the best of our knowledge, have not yet been told what has happened, and perhaps that is all to the good. Frank?
As has no doubt become apparent to you now, all regular NBC programming has been canceled. Special NBC news reports will be brought to you continuously throughout the evening. Very few people are left alive now who can personally recall the assassination of an American president. That occurred, the last one occurred in 1901 when William McKinley was shot to death. And as we have said many times throughout the afternoon, we're relying entirely on memory for but many of these things. But I believe he was shot to death in Buffalo, New York, was he not?
That's my recollection.
That was in 1901. And it seems that we always think this sort of thing can happen in other countries, but we don't really expect it to happen in the United States. But the historical record will not really bear us out on that. We have had a number of presidents assassinated in this country, the last being McKinley. They tried to shoot President Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, and then former President Truman again in 1950, and now John F. Kennedy in 1963. So for the latest developments in Washington, let's return to NBC News correspondent Martin Agronsky in Washington.
The leaders of the Congress of the United States have united in bipartisan unity in this tragic moment. Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield of Montana, the man who now occupies the office last held by our new president, Lyndon B. Johnson, his Republican opposite number, Illinois' Senator Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader in the Senate, and Oregon's Democratic Wayne Morris, speak now. Senator Mansfield was just speaking. Unfortunately, a mechanical failure has cut off the sound from the picture. We'll come back with the statements of Senator Mansfield, the Majority Leader, the Minority Leader, Senator Everett Dirksen, and Senator Wayne Morris of Oregon, Democratic Senator Wayne Morris of Oregon later. The man around whom they are now rallying, Senator President Lyndon Baines Johnson, is a very, very close friend, a very, very well-known, intimate friend of all of the members of the Senate of the United States. Lyndon Baines Johnson, at the age of 55, takes office as President of the United States with probably a more vast governmental experience is behind him than any president we have ever had. He has been in the House of Representatives for, I think, 4 terms. He was elected twice to the Senate of the United States, served as the Senate Majority Leader, where his record was as an extremely able legislative leader, a man who accomplished much in the office. His knowledge, his companionship with the members of the Senate of the United States must certainly serve him in good stead, as they did his predecessor, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Additionally, throughout the Kennedy administration, Senator Vice President Johnson, then Vice President Lyndon Johnson, now President Lyndon Johnson, served the President of the United States in many capacities that gave him an intimate knowledge and insight into the duties of the office that he now assumed. He was on the National Security Council and the National Security Council Executive Committee. He served in every possible way, had every possible experience that a man could have, knew intimately the workings of our government. He is eminently qualified, certainly in terms of experience, to assume the terrible duties that await him now. And now we're informed that the mechanical obstruction to hearing the words of the Senate leaders has been removed, and we hear now first from Senator Mansfield of Montana, the majority leader, then from the Republican.
Passing of John Fitzgerald Kennedy is not only a tragedy for the nation which he so ably represented, but is, I think, also a mark upon the respectability and the responsibility of some of our citizens. This good, this decent, this kindly man, this harassed man who had so much on his shoulders and received from some people so little in the way of support in return, this man has now gone to his reward. And I will miss him as a personal friend. The nation will miss him as a great president. And the world will miss him as a great leader.
There are some things that are simply incredible and leave one absolutely speechless. This is one of them.
In this dark, tragic hour, all I can say is what I said on the floor of the Senate. This is the time for every American to pray. Pray for the president and pray for the country.
So the leaders of the Senate of the United States demonstrate in these words the traditional and the essential unity that goes beyond party in this particular moment of national tragedy. There can be no doubt that the Congress of the United States will unite firmly, will help in every possible way their new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. He is their close friend, as his predecessor was, and there is every certainty that the new president of the United States will receive every possible help that he possibly can, that can be afforded to him by the members of the Congress of the United States, regardless of party. The words you have just heard from Mr. Mansfield, the majority leader, from Senator Everett Dirksen, the minority leader, from Wayne Morse of Oregon, all indicate what is truly a feeling that permeates the entire Congress of the United States today, and demonstrates the kind of essential unity that exists now in the Congress as it rallies behind the new president. And now back to New York.
The black, ugly words are in print. President shot dead. President dead. Common headlines that will appear on every newsstand, probably every newspaper in the world tomorrow morning. But there is the possibility, and it is a possibility only, that the man who perpetrated this action may have been found. Frank?
Well, his name is Lee H. Oswald. He has been arrested in connection with the shooting of a Dallas policeman outside a theater where police had been sent on a tip that the man had gone there. There is reason to believe, according to police, that he is somehow connected with the assassination of President Kennedy. He is being described now as a prime suspect, although the actual words that he is the man who committed the crime has not as yet been used. Not a great deal is known about this Oswald. We will get more information as we go on. We do know that he has been identified by police in Dallas as chairman of an organization known as Fair Play for Cuba Committee. And a police captain, Pat Ganaway, said the suspect was an employee in the building where the rifle used in the assassination was found. Ganaway said the suspect had visited Russia and was married to a Russian. This was not immediately confirmed. Now, according to my understanding, and Bill, you can help me with this, this is the building, a depository for books.
The Texas School Book Repository, I think it's called.
Right? Which is located just across the parkway down which the presidential motorcade was traveling at that time. And is there not an arrow there?
The arrow, yes, Frank, should be pointing to the fifth floor window from which it is believed the fatal shots were fired.
And there
were photographers who said they saw a rifle being pulled in from the window.
And you can see the people gathered outside the building. And then the rifle itself, I believe we have a picture of it.
Yes, there should be one there of the rifle being removed from the building. There it is, variously described as a 303.
Well, perhaps all the experts could recognize it immediately, but it obviously has a telescopic sight on it. And the best we can make out now, the president's motorcade had really traveled perhaps a few yards beyond this point, and that the fatal shots that were fired from behind and struck him in the back of the head, and then incongruously, some way, another bullet struck him in the front of the neck.
One reporter, Frank, who was traveling in the motorcade, says it's his guess that the assassin had about a 45-degree angle on the president, so that it was not head-on or directly from the rear, but on the side. So, more on Oswald here.
Please, go ahead.
He came back to Fort Worth, it says here, from Russia last year, after having been in the Soviet Union since 1959, where he worked in Minsk in a factory, left after he apparently became disillusioned with his life under communist rule. He'd gone to Russia after he got out of the Marine Corps, announced he wanted to stay there, changed his mind, and applied for a passport in 62, saying he wanted to return to the United States with the Russian wife. He met and married in the Soviet Union. They have an infant child. It was not made clear here whether or not he brought the wife and child back to this country. Yes, it is. I'm reading as quickly as I can. Passport was issued, and he and his family came to this country. And it was in 1959, after he'd gone to the Soviet Union, that Oswald told American embassy officials there that he had applied for Soviet citizenship, but apparently he never followed through on that. Again, he is only a suspect, but he is identified as a prime suspect in the assassination of President Kennedy. It is reported from Washington that House Speaker McCormick says the president's body will lie in state at the White House tomorrow. Speaker McCormick said he thinks the body will be taken to the Capitol Sunday and remain in the Great Rotunda until about noon Monday. Further plans, as you can well appreciate, are indefinite, but it's understood that the actual funeral services will be held in Boston. Traditionally, presidents who die in office have lain in state in the Rotunda. Now, we have ready for you a recording of the voice of New York Republican Governor Nelson Rockefeller commenting on the passing of President Kennedy, and we would play that for you now.
This is a shocking and terrible tragedy for the nation and the world. Mrs. Rockefeller and I join with all New Yorkers and every American in extending heartfelt sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and the President's family. May God grant strength and guidance to Lyndon Johnson as he assumes his grave responsibilities under these tragic circumstances. The prayers of all of us will be with him. I've proclaimed for the state of New York a 30-day period of mourning, and I have directed that all state offices shall be closed on the day of the president's funeral.
The President of the United States is dead. Lyndon Baines Johnson is the new President of the United States. The body of John Fitzgerald Kennedy in a bronze casket is aboard an Air Force jet, winging its way back from Dallas, Texas, where he was felled today by shots from a high-powered rifle, which has been recovered from a building where it is believed that the assassin was located. And if first indications or suspicions are correct, the assassin was an employee in the building, Lee Oswald, who seems to have a record of association with left-wing causes, is under arrest, undergoing intensive interrogation in Dallas at this moment. He was arrested near or in a theater in Dallas shortly after the shooting, and during his arrest, a Dallas policeman was shot and killed. The suspect, Lee Oswald, was quoted as saying, "At the time of his arrest, it is all over now." Aboard the Air Force plane coming back from Texas with the body of the late president is the new president, Lyndon Johnson. It will arrive in Washington at about 5 minutes past six Eastern Daylight Time this evening, which is about an hour or an hour and 5 minutes from now. NBC News, as you can appreciate, has mobile units at the Air Force base, and we will attempt to bring you pictures of that scene as it occurs. We have been advised by House Speaker John McCormick that the president's body will lie in state at the White House tomorrow. It is expected that sometime later it will be taken to the rotunda of the Capitol, the giant area underneath the dome which separates the two wings of Congress. Former President Eisenhower has been among the world notables to give his reaction to the tragic loss of the American president. We'd like to bring you his statement at this time.
I share the sense of shock and dismay that the entire nation must feel at the despicable act that took the life of the nation's president. On the personal side, Mrs. Eisenhower and I share the grief that Mrs. Kennedy must now feel. And we send to her our prayerful thoughts and sympathetic sentiments at this, in this hour.
General, how would you counsel the American people at this time?
In the face of such a terrible thing, I'm sure the entire citizenry, the nation, will join as one man in expressing their not only their grief, but their indignation at this act, and will stand faithfully behind the government.
General, could you tell us how you got the word?
I was at a meeting for the United Nations, and while there, a member of the meeting was called out and came back and told us the news. Although at that time, we did not know the president was dead. We did not know when I got back here at that time that he was dead. But, matter of fact, we had the last message we had was one rather of hope. And the entire company merely paused for a minute at the request of the chairman, and each of us, in his own way, said a silent prayer for the president.
Should there be any concern, sir, over national security at a time like this?
No. I think the whole nation now would be almost all of us security agents.
Will the nation be all right in a few months ahead?
Oh, I'm not going to predict anything of that. I just say this. The American nation is a people of great common sense, and they are not going to be stampeded or bewildered.
General, how in history has have assassinations affected the political course of events?
Well, of course, in Lincoln's assassination, the presidency went to a man who was a registered Democrat, Mr. Johnson. In Garfield, I doubt that there was any. And, of course, McKinley, that brought in Theodore Roosevelt. Of course, there have been other attempts in late years. Mr. Truman was at a grave threat toward his life, and Mr. Roosevelt, just before he was inaugurated, you remember, down in, when Mayor Cermak was killed, ran a very grave risk. There, these things have happened, and it seems inexplicable to me, because Americans are loyal, and it's just this occasional psychopathic sort of accident that occurs, and I don't know what we can do about it.
Could you say anything, General, about how people will feel abroad from all your experience with the United Nations and others? How will it be taken abroad?
Well, I think they will be a bit bewildered. This, in the civilized countries of the world, this doesn't happen so often. And you remember in the starting of World War One, the murder of the Archduke Ferdinand, I think his name was. Why, this itself almost, one of the contributory causes to that war. And, but here, I just don't know what happens. And it, but we are a nation that where our freedoms are allowed, are observed in such a way that everybody is ready to, I mean, everybody is, you might say, capable of doing this if he's ready to put his own life on the line.
General, how will you spend the rest of today and tomorrow? How will you spend the rest of today and then tomorrow?
Okay. I have canceled the dinner date that I had for tonight. Tomorrow, I'm going immediately to my home, and if I am wanted for any purpose whatsoever, I will, of course, be available.
General,
Did you have any advice for the American people at this time?
No, as I said, I know the American people will stand solid, and they will not be stampeded.
Thank you, Mr. President. Right.
Thank you. Good night, fellows.
Former President Eisenhower, commenting on the passing of President Kennedy, who was killed this afternoon in Dallas, Texas, by an assassin's bullet fired from a high-powered rifle. Frank?
Just late word from Dallas that the condition of Texas Governor John Connally, who was wounded in the assassination of President Kennedy, has been described in the most recent medical bulletin as satisfactory. Satisfactory is the condition of Texas Governor John Connally. NBC's Richard Valeriani has been at the White House in Washington throughout the afternoon, and understood that crowds are gathering there. There's a certain feeling of hopelessness that goes with these things, but everyone turns to his neighbor and whoever is near him and tries some way to absorb the full impact of the knowledge. And there's not a great deal that can be done. People around the world are trying to accommodate themselves to what has happened in the United States. Now, as we can see, President Eisenhower a while ago was still wrestling with the enormity of the idea and trying to reconcile it with his basic conviction that Americans are decent people and that don't do this sort of thing. But it has happened with alarming regularity over the years. So let's go to the White House now in Washington and NBC's Richard Valeriani to see what the situation is there.
The new president of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, is on his way to Washington from Dallas. He is scheduled to land at Andrews Air Force Base in the presidential jet, Air Force One, in about an hour from now. The body of the late president, John Kennedy, is also aboard the plane. Members of the cabinet are going out to Andrews to meet the new president. Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy is also believed to be aboard the plane. President Johnson, the White House announces, will have a statement to make at the airport on arrival. He will then fly to the White House by helicopter, and after that, his plans are indefinite. The two Kennedy children, Caroline and John Jr., are here at the White House. They have not yet been told of their father's death. They are with a nursemaid, Miss Marge Shaw. Also in the White House is the late president's brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, who is making arrangements for the funeral. He is coordinating this with members of the military. Mrs. Shriver, the late president's sister, has flown to Hyannis to be with Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, the president's father. Outside in front of the White House along Pennsylvania Avenue, crowds have been gathering since shortly after confirmation of the president's death. Extra police details have been assigned to the area. They have roped off one side of the street to keep the crowds back. They are keeping pedestrians moving. The crowd is silent, very grim-faced. We saw one student from Georgetown University crying. There was a girl from the Peace Corps who told one of our reporters, Ed Goff of NBC Washington, that I myself am part of the legacy he, President Kennedy, has left for the world. We are also told that, contrary to reports from Dallas, no Secret Service agent was killed in the gunfire. We are also told that Secret Service agents have been assigned to protect the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, who was next in line after President Johnson. This is Richard Valeriani, NBC News at the White House.
Local people flocked to a church in New Ross, Ireland tonight to offer prayers when they heard of the assassination of President Kennedy. The president came to that area of County Wexford in Ireland, the home of his ancestors, in June during his European tour. John V. Kelly, a New Ross auctioneer who met Kennedy at the time, told newsmen the people here are deeply grieved. People heard the news on television and immediately ran to neighbors who did not have sets and told them. So the shockwaves go around the world. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is Arkansas Senator Fulbright. He worked very closely with President Kennedy in the implementation of this administration's foreign policy. In Washington, Senator Fulbright has made some comment on the assassination of President Kennedy. We would like to bring you a report on that now. So to Washington and the reaction of Senator John Fulbright, Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Assassination of President Kennedy is a tragedy beyond words for his family, for his country, and for the world. It is an unspeakable crime. I extend my heartfelt sympathy to his family. They have lost a loved one, I have lost a friend. The American people have lost a president who has led the country with wisdom, with honor, and with dedication. In the face of so sudden a tragedy, we should be thankful we have tested institutions of government which will continue to function in an orderly manner. We are also fortunate that President Johnson is a man of long and broad experience in government. Confronted with this tragic emergency, all Americans should unite behind our new president and demonstrate the strength of our democracy to ourselves and to the world.
We do not know yet who informed President Johnson of the passing of President Kennedy, but we are reminded that it was another Texan, House Speaker Sam Rayburn, whose duty it became to inform former President Harry Truman of the passing of the late President Roosevelt in Georgia. He had just been speaking with Mr. Truman, as a matter of fact, a few moments before, I think, and he called him to his office and told him that he was now the President of the United States. President Johnson is on his way back to Washington, Andrews Air Force Base. Should be arriving there, perhaps a little less than an hour from now. We heard from Washington a few moments ago that he will have some remarks to make at the airport when he arrives. It would, let us put it this way, it would surprise us if within the next day or two, the president does not make a nationwide address, but we have no information on that. The president's cabinet, or a good portion of it, was on its way to the Far East when word reached them of the assassination of President Kennedy. They immediately turned around en route. The last report we had was that they had touched down in Honolulu on their way back to the United States. Well, the president's cabinet, of course, is his own choice. He chooses or he selects the men that he wants to serve as heads of the various executive departments that are under his domain. Vice President Kennedy now, of course, can choose his, President Lyndon Johnson can select his own cabinet members or retain those that were chosen by President Kennedy. This is one of the hundreds of different ways that the nation and the capital and the people in the government must adjust themselves to the loss of President Kennedy. To talk with us about that now, here is NBC's Mark Negronsky in Washington with some thoughts about the effect on the cabinet.
The chief members of the cabinet of the United States, that is the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. McNamara, the Secretary of Commerce, Mr. Hodges, and the Secretary of the Interior, Mr. Udall, are all on the plane that Frank has just mentioned that has turned around and is trying to get back now to Washington. It is the custom, it is the tradition when a president dies, that each member of the cabinet submits automatically his resignation. The incoming president then either accepts the resignation or instructs the cabinet officer to remain at his post. Automatically, those resignations, we can assume, will be submitted at this time, and President Johnson will then have to make up his mind whom he wishes to keep and whom he wishes to have go. The members of the cabinet are to meet the president's plane when it arrives at Andrews Air Force Base in about an hour from now. They will then accompany President Johnson to the White House. A well-informed White House source is quoted as having said that it is very likely that President Johnson will spend tonight in the White House. That he will not only assume immediately the duties, but also the residence of the President of the United States. The body of John Fitzgerald Kennedy will be carried to the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And tomorrow, as the Speaker of the House, John McCormick, has announced, and Mr. McCormick is now next in line to the presidency of the United States, occupies the position that Lyndon Johnson occupied as vice president in terms of succession. Mr. McCormick has said that the body of the president will lie in state tomorrow, of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, will lie in state tomorrow in the White House, will then lie in state in the rotunda, that is, underneath the Capitol Dome in the capital of the United States on Sunday and until noon on Monday. And at the White House, we're informed that the final burial ceremonies will probably be in Boston, not here in Washington, though apparently is not decided as yet whether President Kennedy shall be buried in Arlington National Cemetery or whether he will be buried in Boston in a Kennedy family plot. The members of the family have not yet made that decision. Sergeant Shriver, the head of the Peace Corps and Mr. Kennedy's brother-in-law, is in charge of the funeral preparations, but Mr. Shriver has not indicated as yet what the final plans shall be. The members of the cabinet, of course, must rally around the new president, will fully intend to, will offer all of the advice that they possibly can. This is a government that under John Fitzgerald Kennedy worked very closely together, not in the sense of holding frequent cabinet meetings, they didn't, but everyone else always knew what the other was doing. And Vice President Lyndon Johnson, or President Lyndon Johnson, fortunately, throughout the Kennedy term of office, was included in all of the meetings with the cabinet, participated fully in many of the major decisions, the state decisions, was a contributing member of the National Security Council, the Chief Advisory Council, which dealt with all of the great problems of state and sat at the president's right hand throughout all the moments of crisis, such as the Cuban emergency. He is fully familiar with all of the duties that he's called upon to assume, and of course will get every kind of help that he possibly can get from the members of the cabinet. It is much too soon to speculate. No one wishes to. No one is in the mood to speculate as to which members of the cabinet President Johnson will keep, which he will ask to go. This is a matter that will be decided much later, I'm sure, when the first shock of this terrible tragedy has worn off and when President Johnson begins to function in his new office. These are the primary developments that have occurred so far here in Washington. It's a question now of waiting the arrival of President Lyndon Johnson, who will make a statement to the nation when he arrives at the airport, which will be in approximately 50 minutes or so from now, if all goes according to schedule. We will hear then the reaction of the new president to the terrible tragedy and to the enormous responsibility that has fallen upon his shoulders. He has not been quoted yet as having said anything, and apparently will be trying to compose his thoughts as he makes this tragic flight back from Dallas here to the United States, where to the capital of the United States, and from where he will now assume the duties of the presidency, as he has already been sworn in as President of the United States. And that's the story as it is developed so far here in the capital. Now, back to you, Frank, in New York.
Not in contradiction to what Martin just told you, but in amplification of what he said, we did have one report that President Johnson said immediately after being sworn in aboard the Air Force plane, "All right, let's get this plane back to Washington." NBC News, as you perhaps have realized, has canceled all of its regular programming. None of the programs that you ordinarily see will be brought to you throughout the course of this evening. We will, however, remain on the air and bring you reports, continuing reports on this story as it continues to unfold. We have mobile units and correspondents assigned to the key points in the story. We have a mobile unit at Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, where we expect the plane bringing President Johnson and the body of the late President Kennedy back to Washington to arrive shortly. We are being joined, of course, with all of our affiliates, and requirements are that periodically, in the course of a broadcast day, that these affiliates pause, or that we pause and allow these affiliates an opportunity to identify themselves. So we shall do that now. We pause for station identifications.